Hi everyone, welcome to another Chatham House Twitter space and our second Accept Twitter space. I'm really looking forward to being able to include you all in today's discussion. For Chatham House, our Accept work looks at three different geographies. So it looks at Sudan's borderlands with Ethiopia and Libya, looking at gold and the contestation of land and agricultural products. It looks at Iraq and the Levant, where we're considering pharmaceuticals, narcotics, agricultural products, and the flow of money. And finally, it includes research on human smuggling and trafficking across East and West Africa to Libya. It is this last geography that we're touching on today. We'll be focusing on the conflict dynamics and economic factors in East Africa, West Africa, and Libya, and their interaction with the conflict supply chain of human smuggling and trafficking, specifically looking at the local, national, and transnational interconnections with a focus on certain key hubs such as Kufra, Sebha, and Agadez. And now, without further ado, let me introduce you to today's brilliant speaker, Tim Eaton. Tim is a senior research fellow with Chatham House's Middle East and North Africa program, as well as the Accept case study lead for this research on human smuggling and trafficking across East and West Africa. More generally, Tim's research focuses on the political economy of the Libyan conflict, and in 2018, he authored a report on the development of Libya's war economy, which illustrates how economic activities have become increasingly connected to violence. Welcome, Tim. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Of course. So with that short introduction, you will, of course, all realise that Tim is the perfect speaker to be talking to us today, which means that I think we should probably dive straight in with the first question. So before we get into the details of the Accept research you were conducting, I was hoping to basically take a step back and ask you if you could give us a bit of background on the history of migration in the regions you were studying. As I understand it, the routes and the regions that make up your Accept research have long been interconnected through trade and seasonal migration. So I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit more about the history of this and what specific dynamics led you to focus on this in your Accept research.
Of course, thank you. Hello to everyone listening. So yeah, I think it's pretty well known, isn't it, that, of course, the African continent's been connected over the centuries by trade, the movement of people. Different changes in countries in Africa have precipitated shifts in the way that those trade patterns have evolved and moved, notably, for example, the discovery of oil in North Africa and a drive for demand for labour led to increased seasonal migration of people. In other cases, of course, goods have traversed caravans in the Sahara and through the Sahel for centuries. But equally, the modern world has changed the economics of those routes. So in some cases, for example, it might have made sense to move low-value goods large distances along the Sahara and through desert trails with camel caravans. But that's less the case in 2023. And we've seen, of course, the advent of deep-sea shipping and containers change the way that that set of trade works. And in many cases, actually, we've seen some of those areas become more closely connected with illicit trade, given that to make a profit in these areas, you equally need to probably focus on goods that have a higher return on investment and a better profit margin. So these dynamics, of course, are highly complex and constantly shifting. But I guess the reason that we wanted to look at them is because ultimately what the Accept project is trying to do is understand how conflict or the impact of conflict traverses borders. And so what we're doing through our work is looking at how developments in one country might impact developments in another. And so that's why we're focused on human smuggling and trafficking, which of course has been a massive story really since the fall of the Gaddafi regime in 2011, the growth of irregular migration along those routes and the dynamics that have ensued have been, you know, covered in so many ways in depth. But I think it's worth looking at how those shifts have changed over the last decade to see and help us answer that question about how developments in different places along these supply chains impact one another.
Great. Thank you so much for that answer. I think it perfectly frames the discussion and the next question I'm hoping to ask you, which really brings us to the heart of the Accept research that we're conducting. So in particular, all the research that we're doing at Chatham House for Accept is focused on the concept of conflict supply chains. And I was wondering if you could tell us a bit about what this means and specifically about the conflict supply chain of human smuggling and trafficking.
Well, I think we're still trying to work it out, kind of. We've obviously been debating it among ourselves for probably years now. But in essence, going back to that initial question, how does one geography connect to another? How do changes in one location lead to changes or ripple effects in another? We felt that perhaps one of the best ways to do this is to look at supply chains, because ultimately, it's the movement of goods, services, and people through these geographies that are the most concrete kind of connections between them. And in looking at human smuggling and trafficking, there are quite clearly defined patterns of movement from East and West Africa via Libya that have developed. Clearly, those precede the Libyan revolution in 2011, but have been exacerbated and changed significantly since that point. So what we're looking to do with this concept of the transnational supply chain is connect it to developments in conflict. So what we really want to understand is how developments in these geographies connect to conflict directly or indirectly, and how those developments might shape the supply chain further along in its interactions with other geographies. So effectively looking at human smuggling and trafficking as a kind of means of understanding how these geographies are connected, and helping us to explore how conflict in these locations has led to ripple effects elsewhere.
Brilliant. I think it makes it very clear why, when you're examining such a vast geography, you need this kind of research framing. Now, if we're to zoom in a little bit, I know that within your research, you're focusing on a number of key hubs that are critical to understanding this supply chain of human smuggling and trafficking and its relation to transnational conflict. So I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about this hub approach and why you've chosen it.
Yeah, well, I think you alluded to it at the beginning. I mean, clearly these are massive geographies, and we're talking about a dizzying array of developments, factors to follow. So the logic here is that given that we're looking at human smuggling and trafficking, we know that there are particular areas that have become deeply involved in those activities. So what we're doing is we're zooming in on a number of places along the supply chain. So we're looking at Edo State in Nigeria, which is a key point of origin for many people traveling. We're looking at Agadez in Niger, which has become a critical transit point and hub for those moving onward to Libya. And on the East African side, we're looking in Ethiopia, and we're looking in Northern State in Sudan as points of both origin and transit for people moving from East Africa. And then in Libya, we're looking at the southeast of the country in Kufra, a key hub for the movement of people, but also of informal trade, and Sebha in the southwest, which serves the same function. And then finally, we're looking at the Libyan city of Zawiya, which has become closely associated with the sector, including dynamics around the detention of migrants and exploitation of migrants, but also of launching sea crossings of migrants to Europe. So by zooming in on each of those places and looking at what's happened in those places since 2010, we're trying to understand actually what role human smuggling and trafficking plays in that geography. How important is it to the economy? How do people rely on it? Has it changed things? Has it led to further competition? Is there violence over control of these activities? So that we can kind of come up with a comparative assessment of how developments in one place impacts developments in another. And I think that's kind of where we would look to differentiate our research from the wide array of other research and ongoing research on migration more broadly and human smuggling and trafficking more specifically, because we're really interested in this connection to conflict. And by conflict, we're adopting quite a broad lens. We're looking at both what we would call direct violence, you know, the shooting violence, but also the structural drivers of engagement in the sector and harm. So structural violence, for example, in southern Libya, you could explore how the collapse of public services and a paucity of alternatives and the collapse of subsidies have led in turn to an increasingly important role played by the illicit sector. So we're trying to look at the interaction of these factors in the development of the sector.
If we stay for a moment with this hub approach that you've taken. I was wondering if we could zoom in specifically on Kufra in southeast Libya, because you've written a recent expert comment about this, focusing on the nature of human smuggling and trafficking in this location. And I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about the research that led to this expert comment and more generally what the impact of human smuggling and trafficking is having on communities there and how it relates to conflict.
Absolutely. So it's clear that different hubs play a slightly different role in the sector and are impacted in different ways. Edo as a point where people depart, Niger and in particular as a transit and embarkation point, and Libya as a place where there is a market, of course, for labour, but also a point where many people seek to reach Europe. So when we look at changes, you can see how the collapse of central authority in Libya in 2011 leads to a rapid growth of the illicit sector and a kind of a development of localized security markets. If you look at where Kufra fits in these developments, so Kufra had actually pretty large investments in local agriculture projects. Really, though, from the kind of the 1970s onwards, it's been connected with a number of bouts of violence. The Libyan-Chadian war and aftermath led the area to be quite militarized. The impact of sanctions on Libya after Lockerbie led to the deterioration of much of the agricultural sector. And increasingly, kind of by the turn of the century, you see that Kufra is quite reliant on cross-border trade. And the interviews that we did indicated that it was seen as a good spot to be posted to, particularly if you're working in customs, because you could make quite a significant amount of money from movement across the borders. And Kufra is well integrated with trade routes in Sudan and in Chad, and there are a lot of interrelations between those actors in control. But Kufra also is very much an unresolved conflict, if you like, over local ownership. The two broad social groups, the Arab Zway, the vast majority of the population, and the Tebu, both have a claim, if you like, to ownership of the area. But it's the Arab Zway that have dominated the governance of the region since 2011. And actually, whilst Tebu and the Zway fought together in 2011, that difference over who should be in control has never really gone away, and there have been outbreaks of violence since that point. And I think what's interesting and what we've kind of been looking at is how human smuggling and trafficking fits into this. So control of the cross-border trade was a key part of the conflict in a way, because it's such an important source of income. You can see that there were big ditches in the desert that were dug to prevent opposing groups from being able to trade, and strong attempts to try and consolidate trading routes after 2011. But actually, the situation that we've got now is interesting, because the Tebu are locked out of the governing arrangements in Kufra. But actually, the movement of human smuggling and trafficking seems to actually be going from the Kufra area through Tebu-controlled areas, indicating that whilst this political conflict between the Tebu and the Zway remains unresolved, or at least remains dominated by the Zway's representation, the relations between the communities actually seems to function best on the level of negotiating over the movement of illicit goods, and particularly in the human smuggling and trafficking sector. So that's kind of an interesting point, that there's ongoing political dispute, but it's through human smuggling and trafficking that the most notable interactions between those communities seem to be taking place. And it's also worth noting that what's happening in Kufra is very, very local in origin. And actually, when you look at the more national picture in Libya, it seems that the affiliations of the local actors to the national actors are largely in order to pursue their own local agendas, as opposed to being part of something broader. And we've seen the local communities switch sides and have various outreach to national level players. Very interestingly, though, what also seems to have occurred is there seems to be some convergence of interests between the local governance arrangements and what's happening in the illicit sector. So a story across Libya, but most notably in Libya's south, is that since 2011, there's been less and less support from the central government. Few development projects, intermittent salaries, and Kufra, of course, was associated with the Eastern-based authorities and not with the authorities in Tripoli from 2014 onwards, which also impacted their ability to obtain funds. And it seems that against this backdrop, the locals have sought to develop their own sources of revenue. And in fact, their sources of revenue that have developed from an actual real private sector, albeit one that isn't subject to any meaningful legal oversight. So from the tax-free import of goods from the northeastern coast in the city of Ajdabiya down, you're seeing trade moving through the Kufra area into key points in Sudan and Chad, and really the Kufran economy benefiting from those revenues. And the Kufra Construction Fund seems to be building from those revenues to actually create a form of municipal income and potentially some municipal spending on the basis of Kufra's illicit sector. So this is really interesting and kind of a mixed picture when you look at conflict. In some ways, human smuggling and trafficking has exacerbated the competition between rival actors, but it's also resulted in an equilibrium of sorts where they can do deals and work together. And whilst the violence of the sector is awful, and Kufra Detention Centre is by all accounts one of the worst places that a migrant could find themselves in Libya, actually in some ways it's offsetting the lack of support from the central government and supporting a degree of local autonomy, which is going to be hard to dial back. And it's notable in this sense that when Khalifa Haftar sent a former regime commander from the city of Kufra to kind of re-establish control over the security sector, when he sought to control the Kufra Construction Fund, there was a big blowback. And that local control is really important. And actually, the Kufra's main armed faction, Subla Salam, has an ongoing kind of arrangement with the Haftars for management of the movement of illicit goods. So it's Kufra has developed a degree of autonomy from 2011 onwards. And actually, the vibrance of its illicit sector is a big part of how it does that. Of course, that's kind of a counterintuitive message for many policymakers who would see this sector, which has many awful abuses, as inherently bad, and also probably explains why the attempts to clamp down on these types of activities are not working, because even those in charge of the response are connected to those who are benefiting from it. So that's why I think it's quite a mixed picture that Kufra shows, but an accurate one of how these supply chains emerge and how they connect to conflict.
Thank you so much for that. I think particularly the point on the Kufran Construction Fund is incredibly fascinating, and your points more generally perfectly demonstrate the complexity of the dynamics we're trying to research, both in terms of your work on the conflict supply chain, on human smuggling and trafficking, and really the ACCEPT research more generally. It also makes me wish that we could touch on all seven of the hubs in this conversation, but that will have to wait for future discussions. So before we wrap up this Twitter space, I was just hoping to ask you one final question. So we've looked at the research you've conducted so far, zoomed in on Kufra, but I was wondering if you can tell me a bit more about what the next steps are for you.
Right. So what we've been trying to do is build an understanding of developments in each of the hubs and a deep understanding of how those developments connect to the emergence of human smuggling and trafficking. So the next stage is to do a comparative analysis of these dynamics and also to explore the potential causalities of how changes in one place impact changes in another. So going back to Kufra briefly, actually, what we do know is that when there was large-scale violence between Tebu and Zway, actually, that seemed to negatively impact the trade moving through the area. So in some senses, you can see how conflict can depress this trade and led to other routes. Equally, the reason it seems that Tebu and Zway were able to agree on onward routes of human smuggling and trafficking was the difficulty of moving migrants north through the routes. So you can see that we're trying to pick out these dynamics and understand how they intersect. And we're going to be doing this more broadly across the case study. For example, we're looking at how the reductions of migrants moving from Niger to Libya from 2016 onwards, following major international policy intervention, was offset by the growth of artisanal gold mining, which continues. And in fact, how those gold mines have also reoriented many of the routes and the power dynamics in the area. So that's kind of the next stage. We're trying to build those individual analyses of the hubs and what we would call a kind of conflict systems analysis to understand how they intersect. It's quite a big task, probably bit off a bit more than we can chew in a way, but I think it's going to be very interesting, particularly to look at these things over time. And we've been supplementing our analysis of our interview data and our locally based work with satellite data as well to understand some of the broader changes. So, for example, how the deterioration of agriculture in southern Libya has played into these dynamics, or, as I mentioned, how the growth of artisanal gold mining, which comes in the mid-2010s, changes these aspects. And then finally, how things like checkpoint economies have emerged and what that means for conflict dynamics. So we've been looking at the checkpoints that have sprouted up across Libya since 2010 and how they've changed and how they've been used to generate revenues. So we know, for example, that goods reaching the south of Libya are more expensive than goods purchased on the northwestern coast, because the costs of moving the goods to the south increase as you go through checkpoints which expect payments, etc. So the next steps really are starting to put this together and trying to make sense of the analysis and understand these interconnections.
Thank you so much for that, Tim. I think lots and lots to come and all very, very exciting. That unfortunately does bring us to a close for today. Thank you so much, Tim, for taking the time to talk to me about all of this. I've learned a great deal, I'm sure all the listeners have too. In fact, I should say a huge thank you to everyone listening today, and thank you for spending some time listening to all the developments of the Accept research. I've also spotted a couple of other members of the wider Accept team on the call today, so thank you also for joining. You'll be able to find more on the Chatham House's Accept research on the Chatham House website, including the expert comment on Kufra that we specifically mentioned. We'll also be publishing another exciting piece in the coming weeks, which looks at human smuggling and trafficking in Zawiya. So that's another hub that Tim is looking at in Libya. So do keep your eyes peeled for that one as well. And then if you have any particular questions on Accept, you can always send Tim or I or other members of the team a message on Twitter. And for information on the wider research program, you can visit the accept-research.org website, where all of the work that the whole program is conducting is aggregated. So that's it really for today. Thank you again, Tim. Big thank you to the Chatham House communications team for all of your help on the technical side and for everyone listening. So have a wonderful rest of the day.
Thank you, everyone. And thank you, Leah, for hosting.